Now, we're going to be taking a look at not only the 1972 Borghese putsch attempt, again, arms from Otto Skorzeny, assistance from CIA, participation by, among others, Vito Micheli, a P2 member and SID chief we're going to look at, Michele Sindona, Licio Gelli, and others. But, this whole series of coup attempts here we're going to be looking at in a book called In Banks We Trust. That book was authored by Penny Lernoux, last name L-E-R-N-O-U-X, published in copyright 1984, published in hardcover by the Anchor Press, or which is in turn a subsidiary of Doubleday. And of the CIA's assistance to of a series of coup attempts in Italy and the use, the aforementioned use, of Michele Sindona as the conduit for that, Penny Lernoux writes as follows. In the years after World War II, the CIA pumped some $65 million into Italy to support centrist and right-wing political parties, as revealed by the House of Representatives' Pike Report on CIA activities. Despite this massive support, the beneficiaries suffered repeated electoral setbacks, unquote, and the CIA apparently concluded that another quick fix, unquote, was necessary in the form of $10 million for the 1972 parliamentary elections. But Nixon's White House, the CIA, and Graham Martin, the then U.S. ambassador to Italy, could not agree on who should get the booty. Martin worried that Sindona had a direct line to the White House because of his association with David Kennedy and Nixon's former law firm. Recall, we look at that at the very top of tonight's broadcast. Sindona had also been active in the 1972 Nixon re-election drive when he put together fundraising campaigns, offered $1 million to the re-election committee on the condition of anonymity. It was refused, and orchestrated right-wing Italian efforts to woo Italian-American voters into Nixon's camp. Ambassador Martin concluded that Sindona was too extremist, his preference for CIA funding being Vito Micheli, a rightist general who headed the scandal-ridden SID, the Italian counterpart of the CIA. Martin wanted total control over the CIA's purse strings in Italy, lest certain people, unquote, meaning Sindona, push the White House into a disastrous program, unquote. There were bitter fights between the ambassador and the CIA station chief over who was crazier, Sindona or Micheli, Martin at one point threatening to put the chief spook on the first plane back to Washington. It was a mess, said an embassy official. There was lots of money floating around, and everybody and his uncle was giving it to Sindona and Micheli. Sindona was a money channel years before Martin asked for control of the funds, unquote. Of course, interrupting, we looked at that with regard to the 70 Borghese coup attempt and the 69 Piazza Fontana bombing. Continuing. The irony is that Martin and the CIA bickered for nothing, since the Sindona and Micheli pipelines both led back to the same neo-fascists. Both men belonged to the P2. Micheli, who received at least $800,000 from Ambassador Martin, was also a member of the neo-fascist Italian social movement of Black Prince Borghese. According to the Italian press, some of the CIA money went to finance an aborted fascist coup against the Italian government, which was organized by Borghese in December of 1970. Also implicated in the coup were Micheli and the Italian terrorist Della Chiai of Ordine Nuovo, the paramilitary arm of the P2, as well as John McCaffrey, chief of the European resistance movement for Britain during World War II. The Scotsman met Sindona after the war when he represented Hambros Bank in Italy. Hambros was a partner with Sindona in an Italian bank, and McCaffrey became close friends with the Sicilian who shared the same right-wing ideology. In an affidavit signed in Ireland in 1981, shortly before his death, McCaffrey stated that he helped Sindona plan the 1970 coup and that he was sure to a moral certainty, unquote, that the CIA was aware of the plot. Convinced that the coup would exclude any attempt at neo-fascist dictatorship, unquote, McCaffrey seemed unaware of Sindona's P2 links, although everyone on the Italian side of the conspiracy was connected to the neo-fascist lodge. Micheli and Sindona were involved in another unsuccessful coup conspiracy in 1973, known as the Rosa dei Venti. Italian judicial authorities uncovered additional evidence implicating Micheli's SID and Della Chiai in the 1969 explosion at Milan's Piazza Fontana, in which 17 died. The bombing was part of the strategy of tension hatched by right-wing SID officials and Borghese's neo-fascists to cause a shift to the right on the part of the Italian Italian voters alarmed by phony leftist bombings. And of course, we looked at BND involvement in same just a second ago.
Okay, and reading from Luigi D'Fonso's book, St. Peter's Banker, we're going to be talking a little bit about the other end of some of those pipelines. According to the 1976 Pike Report, written by the U.S. House Select Committee on Intelligence, Chairman Otis Pike discovered that the U.S. government had spent $10 million in 1972 backing the Christian Democrats and the right in Italy. While Graham Martin was U.S. ambassador to Italy during the Nixon administration, the CIA poured millions of dollars into Italy to support right-wing activities. Of that money, $800,000 went directly to SID chief Vito Micheli, a member of P2 who has since been charged with political conspiracy in the Tora Tora coup attempt led by the late Prince Junio Valerio Borghese. General Micheli, however, was not the only member of P2 who participated in the coup. Carlo Bordoni says that Michele Sindona, in the middle of an argument, boasted that he was one of the masterminds of the aborted coup. Borghese, also known as the Black Prince, a friend of Licio Gelli, had been head of Decima Mas, a group of fascists who operated during 1944 and 1945. Borghese, like Gelli, was a strong supporter of Mussolini and Hitler. During World War II, Borghese received his country's highest award for gallantry as a naval officer. As the leader of Decima Mas, the Black Prince ordered the assassination of partisans and of civilians suspected of protecting partisans. After the war, Borghese spent 4 years in prison for his pro-Nazi affiliations. Confinement, however, did not diminish the prince's political ambitions. And the clash between the far left and the distant right during 1970 set the mood for Borghese's planned coup. Again, remember, the clash between the far left and the distant right during 1970 was entirely fabricated. By December of 1970, the will of reform had swung Italian politics completely toward the left. Pro-Nazi and pro-fascist groups continued in conflict with university students. Warnings persisted that rightists were planning to overthrow the government and establish a presidential dictatorship. Most politicians believed that no one group could or would attempt a coup d'etat. But Communist Party leaders thought differently. Fearing that a rightist coup was in the making, they ordered several standby alerts, directing members to safe houses in the event that the right succeeded in establishing a dictatorship. On December 7th, 1970, 200 military forest rangers stood armed for battle in the mountains near Rieti, about 30 kilometers from Rome. By order of Prince Borghese, 20 rangers entered the Ministry of the Interior. Another group of fascists stood prepared to receive an order to kidnap the President of the Republic, Giuseppe Saragat. At the last moment, however, the coup, for reasons unknown, was canceled. It is unlikely that the coup could have been successful because Borghese lacked the manpower necessary to pull it off. Nevertheless, had he given the order for his men to march on Rome, there would have been bloodshed. Perhaps he realized this. Whatever the reason, after Borghese fled to Spain, a 14-page document was discovered that detailed the plot and subsequent acts of violence planned through 1974. The report also revealed that Vito Micheli had known of the coup but had not informed Parliament. The reason may be that Licio Gelli, his superior in P2, supported Borghese's attempt. In spite of all this obscurity, one thing is clear. On 5 different occasions during the 70s, factions of the extreme right planned to seize control of the Italian government and establish a fascist state. And in at least one other plot, the Rosa dei Venti, Vito Micheli and Licio Gelli were named as principals. Before continuing with the article, we might want to mention broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. Numerous journalists have reported that part of the $10 million that the CIA spent on Italy's 1972 elections was filtered through banks controlled by Michele Sindona, and Sindona confirms this. The CIA, however, will not state whether or not it had a fiduciary relationship with Sindona. Nevertheless, a secret court document now makes it possible to show how, in January 1972, Michele Sindona and John McCaffrey, chief of the European resistance movement for Britain during World War II, planned a coup. In an affidavit taken by one of Sindona's lawyers on February 3, 1981, in Donegal, Ireland, John McCaffrey said, quote, Italy's passage from the post-war economic miracle created by the dynamism and inventiveness of private enterprise to her present state of palsy and chaos has been brought about by the pervasive and continuous operations of left-wing anti-Western forces. These forces have used their customary well-known range of instruments, including the penetration and corruption of individuals and groups, which should have been achieved, though they have been greatly helped, by the existence of an overt, numerically strong Communist Party. As always, the communists have cloaked their allies and fellow travelers with membership in established political parties and institutions and have infiltrated individuals into key posts. The battle for control of Italy, which is now more than half won for the left, was and is still being fought with subtlety and cohesion on all fronts. Now, bear in mind as we continue with this that Mr. McCaffrey's deposition is virtually an in-depth description of what the right wing was doing in Italy. Exactly. Efforts to combat the left wing, we continue with McCaffrey's deposition, efforts to combat the left-wing takeover have been fragmented and completely unorganized. Many of those who should have been natural leaders of the opposition were corrupt, docile, and inept. Those who were intelligent, strong, and successful posed formidable threats to the leftist movement and were targets for elimination. Michele Sindona was a member of the latter group. During my association with Sindona, I did in fact witness a number of attempts in Italy and abroad to unseat him. Ugo La Malfa, Minister of the Italian Treasury, personally influenced many decisions calculated to harm or disrupt Western policies, free enterprise in Italy, and Michele Sindona. Furthermore, during the absence of Jocelyn Hambro, chairman of Hambro's, the British bank, Italian left-wing bankers went to the offices of Hambro's to sow seeds of distrust for Sindona and to predict disaster for his pro-American, pro-capitalism enterprises. Again, bear in mind, this is Nip again, Sindona's pro-Western, pro-American, pro-capitalism enterprises consisted basically in theft and the promulgation abroad of fascist activity. In the context of these events and his pro-American stance, Sindona approached me, fully aware of my own background in the resistance movement, early in 1972 with his plan for a coup, the purpose of which was to establish a government in Italy and Sicily which would be closely allied with the United States. Shortly thereafter, I met with Sindona and a high-ranking military official in Rome, where we discussed the coup being planned by Sindona and the military. At this meeting, I presented a detailed plan for the takeover of the government and for the new administration's first year in office. In view of my background, my collaboration had not only the value of technical competence, but also could be considered as a guarantee of excluding any attempt at neo-fascist dictatorship. Neither the United States nor the United Kingdom could have accepted any such outcome, nor indeed would they have wanted a purely military takeover, even with the best intentions. The idea was to secure the backing of the armed forces for orthodox democratic politicians who wanted a proper parliamentary government and not a branch office of the Kremlin. The military men involved were fully aware of this and did not aspire to any autonomous action, but merely wanted to be the defenders of the Western democratic system. Their part in what was envisaged as a political coup was to provide the authority and control which would have ensured that there was no organized outbreak of anarchy and subversion by the numerous trained squads of rioters and guerrilla fighters which the communists had at their disposal. Among the communists' other most formidable weapons were those who supported them from outside the official party. It is my considered opinion that one of their chief allies was Ugo La Malfa. Following this meeting, Sindona spoke with me on several occasions regarding the proposed coup. It was clear to me from these conversations with Sindona that he was the key to the entire operation. I am sure to a moral certainty that Sindona spoke about the proposed coup with important figures in the American Central Intelligence Agency and with top-level officials in the American Embassy in Rome. I would think it highly probable that the existence of the planned coup was known by Graham Martin, then American ambassador to Italy. There is no doubt but that there exist numerous documents in America which reflect the benevolence on the part of the United States towards the coup organized by Sindona. The coup failed for a variety of reasons. Lack of security criteria among those to take part, the lack of know-how, courage, and conviction on the part of Italian politicians, reflection of this lack of courage on the Italian military leaders, La Malfa's and others' attacks on Sindona, and on the American scene, the emergence of the Watergate upheaval. The American support would not have been military, of course, McCaffrey says. This would not have been necessary, but I did learn that the Italian military men involved in the coup wanted a United States fleet to find itself in the vicinity of Naples while the coup was being launched. And the other reason he gives for failure is of the overall picture in this proposed coup and of the overwhelmingly positive and pro-American role played in it by Michele Sindona, there can be no possible doubt. Excuse me. What McCaffrey did not know when he was assisting Sendona in the formalities of organizing a coup was that behind Michele Sendona were members of Propaganda Due. The Sicilian financier has always been credited with having an ability to keep secrets, not only from his opponents, but from his friends as well. Had he revealed the support of P2 and its neo-fascist elements, Sendona might not have received John McCaffrey's assistance. I should just mention that, as far as my own personal interpretation of this goes, I think that Mr. DeFonso is perhaps being excessively kind to John McCaffrey. Those of you who were listening carefully as we were reading his deposition will probably have recognized basically the ravings of somebody that who certainly, if not an active neo-fascist, is certainly full of neo-fascist sympathies, and to suggest that the Italian government as it stood in 1970 was basically a branch of the Kremlin, and to suggest that people like Michele Sendona and his associates were motivated only by a sort of a warm hearted desire for pro-Western, pro-democratic ideals is either a degree of, it's either, it signifies a degree of stupidity rather incredible in somebody who is as involved in political activities as McCaffrey has been during World War II and afterwards, or else is just basically the prevarication of somebody who's a dyed-in-the-wool dyed-in-the-wool fascist himself.
Either the man was, as Ned Nip said, a dyed-in-the-wool fascist, or he was the stupidest man since Douglas MacArthur. And, of course, we looked at his amazing ability to court all fascists of all kinds during our Aryan Nation series. Taking a look at the participation in the aforementioned 1972 Borghese coup attempt by Stefano Della Chiaia, a ubiquitous player in Italian far-right politics, along with Licio Gelli, probably the most important and common of the Italian fascist conspirators of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Returning to the book, The Nazi Legacy, which we looked at earlier, at about Stefano Della Chiaia and the 1970 coup attempt, the authors write as follows. But there was nothing quiet about Della Chiaia's life, for in 1970, he took on an assignment which was the most ambitious of his career, the attempted overthrow of the Italian state. The coup d'etat was organized by a man who had by now become Della Chiaia's patron, Prince Valerio Borghese, friend of Léon de Grelle, and Léon de Grelle, by the way, was a Belgian Nazi and one of the key leaders of the Odessa, the one of the post-war Nazi self-help groups. Friend of Léon de Grelle and known by all his right-wing comrades as Il Comandante. It was planned for December 7th, 1970, a date deliberately chosen because it marked the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. It was codenamed Tora Tora in memory of the Japanese attack, and the man placed in charge of its most spectacular action was Della Chiaia. At the head of a commando group of 30 men, the toughest veterans of the Avanguardia Nazionale, Della Chiaia led a nighttime raid on the Ministry of the Interior in Rome. The building was deserted as a squad forced its way into the armory and seized 200 machine guns. At midnight, Della Chiaia telephoned his commander, Borghese, and announced that the ministry was in his hands. By then, other squads were ready to seize the radio and television stations, arrest left-wing politicians, and announce that they were in control of the machinery of government. But at the last minute, Il Comandante announced that the coup was to be called off. The troops he ordered should stand down. The operation was aborted. Everyone was stunned. Borghese's second-in-command stormed into his office to demand an explanation, but the old man was implacable. "I have obeyed superior orders," unquote, was all he would say. There has never been a satisfactory explanation of who those superiors were, though there has been no shortage of rumors, including the suggestion that the coup had the secret backing of the U.S. government, which had stationed warships off Malta ready to sail towards Italy as soon as the coup was announced. By the way, we would add that that was no rumor, as we've looked at abundantly before. The CIA and other elements of the government were very much behind that coup. Continuing. Borghese himself refused to divulge the secret, even to his close friend Léon de Grelle, and he went to his grave without ever revealing why the coup, which might have changed the course of Italian history, was so suddenly thrown into reverse. Della Chiaia pulled his men out of the ministry building as efficiently as he led them in. He replaced 199 machine guns, keeping just one as a souvenir, and then, in the early hours of December 8th, he slipped out of Italy for exile in Barcelona. His departure was carefully monitored by the ever-vigilant SID. And we would add that we will be picking up Stefano Della Chiaia in numerous other places, not only later in this broadcast, but others as well.
That's right. And before we continue on to talk about where are they now, which is what we're going to be talking about immediately at the beginning of the next segment, we're going to take a short break, give ourselves a chance to get up and walk. Part 3 of the Mediterranean merry-go-round. And, of course, we're getting now into the thick of things. Last week, those of you who were listening last week were thinking, well, what is this, all stock speculation and money scams? Well, as we are seeing this week, the money scams were for a very specific reason, and they were to support specific fascist activities. We've just been talking about the 1970 Borghese Putsch and others, and the Rosa Deventi coup group, and a variety of others we've been talking about. Apparently, according to John McCaffrey, among others, who was himself actively involved in the plot, direct U.S. affiliation, certainly with money, possibly, as the allegation has been made, with plans to have U.S. warships in the Mediterranean ready to steam ashore at the declaration of a new military state in Italy in the early 1970s.
One of the things that we looked at in our series of in our last program when we were looking at the Vatican banking scandals was how the money go round began to slow down, and as it became increasingly more tangled, we began to look at a series of corpses that began piling up. Judges who were attempting to investigate these things, people who for one reason or another got caught betwixt and between the wrong sides of the wrong forces, people who became key witnesses in investigations or key foci of investigations, such as Messrs. Sindona and Calvi, both of whom met tragic ends, or unnatural ends, I guess we should say. What we're going to be looking at during the immediate portion of the broadcast here is some more interesting developments as various groups began to attempt to penetrate the series of fascist machinations that we've been looking at. Again, international in nature, involving CIA, involving BND, P2 Lodge, and many of the elements thereof. A lot of people, quite a few people, began dropping dead as the various investigations into these things proceeded. And so not only were some people dropping dead, but some others were going on the lam. And we're going to take a look at those right now.
Indeed, and we're going to start off with an obituary from the San Francisco Chronicle for February 7th, 1984, a very well-known name at this point to those of you who have been following the broadcasts. And that name is General Giuseppe Santovito, and the obituary is datelined Florence, Italy. General Giuseppe Santovito, age 65, the former head of Italy's military intelligence, who reportedly was linked to a series of major scandals in recent years, died Sunday. Santovito was arrested December 2nd and charged with revealing secret information about Italian terrorist groups and their foreign links. He was later released from prison to undergo liver surgery. His name had surfaced in investigations ranging from the uncovering of the secret Masonic Lodge, Propaganda Due, to alleged links with a multi-billion dollar arms and drug trafficking ring in the Mideast. And that last provocative sentence there refers, of course, to STEBOM, an organization that we are going to be talking about at great length next week.
So, P2 member Giuseppe Santovito, one of the key people in the aforementioned Super Seismic group lying at the root of so many of these fascist machinations, arrested December 2nd, 1983, dead February 7th, 1984. Like a lot of people we have looked at, and a number of other people we're going to be looking at, particularly in connection with the aforementioned STEBOM Arms for Drugs ring, which is going to connect not only up with P2, but also up with the shooting of the Pope. One of the key people involved in the aforementioned parliamentary investigation of P2 that was headed up by Member of Parliament Tina Anselmi, well, that investigation was co-chaired by a fellow named Franco Calamandre. His obituary appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Monday, September 27th of 1982. An AP story out of Rome, it's headed simply Franco Calamandre, C-A-L-A-M-A-N-D-R-E-I. Franco Calamandre, 65, a communist senator and leading figure in the Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge scandal investigation, died yesterday in a Rome hospital, his family announced. Calamandre worked as a correspondent in London and Beijing for the Italian Communist Party's official newspaper, L'Unità, before being elected to the Senate in 1968. He was best known for his work as vice chairman of a parliamentary commission set up to investigate the Masonic Lodge scandal that brought down the government of Christian Democratic Premier Arnaldo Forlani last year. So Calamandre, obviously as a communist member of parliament, would have been anathema to the people in P2, And he apparently, well, obviously, not apparently, he obviously did not survive his role as the vice chairman of the parliamentary investigation, looking into Licio Gelli and the P2.
Now, of all the major figures that we've been talking about in the last few weeks, virtually all of them have died, almost all of them in some mysterious manner, with the exception of two of them. One of them is Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, who, for a variety of reasons, is still a virtual prisoner in the Vatican, owing to the fact that he cannot leave without facing Italian justice. The other man, which perhaps gives us a hint of the actual power hierarchy of the whole plot against the Pope, the other man who has managed to not die in opposition to people like Michele Sindona, Roberto Calvi, Giuseppe Santovito, Bekir Cheleg, Henry Arsene, and others, is, of course, Licio Gelli. And we're going to read an article about one of the latest, not the latest, but one of the more recent things that happened to Licio Gelli. And this article is from the Wall Street Journal for August 11th, 1983. The headline is, Central Figure in Italian Scandal Has Vanished. Subheaded, Licio Gelli, former leader of P2 Masonic Lodge, missing from Swiss jail. Licio Gelli, the leader of a once secret Masonic lodge in Italy, and a central figure in the Banco Ambrosiano scandal, vanished during the middle of Tuesday night from a high-security prison in Geneva, Switzerland, police said. A lawyer for Mr. Gelli maintained that he was kidnapped, citing bloodstains, chloroform odors, and a hypodermic needle that the lawyer said were found in Mr. Gelli's empty cell. A number of Italian politicians, however, said that Mr. Gelli probably staged an elaborate escape. Swiss authorities said they aren't certain of either theory, but that Mr. Gelli clearly didn't get outside the prison by himself. Mr. Gelli's disappearance created an immediate sensation, especially in Italy, whose citizens have followed a series of bizarre developments that began in May 1981 with the exposure of a secret Masonic lodge called P2. Mr. Gelli, 64 years old, was Grand Master of the Lodge, which consisted of nearly 1,000 highly placed Italians and South Americans, and was accused of being a state within a state. Mr. Gelli fled Italy but was arrested last September at a Swiss bank trying to withdraw funds that had been funneled through Banco Ambrosiano of Milan, a bank that collapsed in the summer of 1982 after its chairman, Roberto Calvi, himself a member of the secret P2 Lodge, was found hanged in London. Well, a couple of things to mention. First of all, since it has been pretty much established since then that Licio Gelli, in fact, did escape, and how he escaped, and that he is probably at last sighting, well, one of the most last reliable sightings was that he was in Uruguay, and we will talk about that later in the broadcast. It does bring back to mind, as we mentioned in the broadcast last week, Michele Sindona's own staged kidnap attempt in which he went so far as to have himself shot in the leg in an effort to evade justice. Michele Sindona, however, evaded justice in the long run, not at all. He was actually imprisoned and then, of course, died in prison, as we related last week. Licio Gelli, however, has avoided the hand of the Grim Reaper.
Now, one of the things for which Licio Gelli may very well have been held to account had he not escaped prison is the single most bloody and most noteworthy terrorist incident in the history of Italian fascist skullduggery, and that is the Bologna bombing of August of 1980. Now, with the Bologna bombing, the merry-go-round is going to begin to turn here. We're going to leave Italy, we're going to touch briefly on some other P2 and P2-related machinations in Italy, and then we're going to jump across the Atlantic. We're going to go to South America, also Central America briefly, but we're going to go to South America, and some of the key people involved in the Bologna bombing are going to crop up on the other side of the Atlantic as well. But with the Bologna bombing, the most notorious of all of the terrorist incidents in Italy during this period, as I say, we're going to leave Italy and the Mediterranean merry-go-round is going to begin to turn in earnest. About the Bologna bombing, David Yollop writes as follows in God's Name. There have been over the past two decades a number of bombing outrages in Italy that remain unsolved. I would add that remaining unsolved is his estimation here. If the Italian authorities ever catch Gelli, they will be in a position, if he chooses to talk and tell the truth, to solve some of those mysterious attacks. These include Milan, 1969, the Piazza Fontana bomb attack, 16 people killed, Bologna, 1974 bomb attack on the Rome-Munich Express, the Italicus near Bologna, 12 people killed, Bologna, 1980 train station bombing, 85 people killed, 182 injured. According to the sworn testimony of a disenchanted follower of Gelli, a neo-fascist called Elio Cialini, C-I-O-L-I-N-I, this last outrage was planned at a P2 meeting held in Monte Carlo on April 11th, 1980. Licio Gelli was the Grand Master at that meeting. Again, according to the testimony of Cellini, the three men responsible for the train station bombing are Stefano Della Chiai, Pierluigi Pagliani, P-A-G-L-I-A-N-I. I've also seen that Pierluigi Pagliai. Some people leave out the N. And Joachim Fiebelkorn. The purpose of this series of appalling attacks was to direct public outrage toward Italian communists by making it appear that they were responsible. Of course, we've looked at that as the strategy of tension. Stefano Della Chiai, one of the key people involved with that, along with Licio Gelli. Remember Della Chiai, Pierluigi Pagliai or Pagliani, and Joachim Fiebelkorn. We're going to be talking about them later in the broadcast on the other side of the Atlantic, but in cahoots with the very same cast of characters. And remember also Ilio Cellini and the meeting at Monte Carlo, because as we're going to begin looking at now, there is not just one P, well, there may be one P2 lodge, but it has branches in many different countries.
That's right, and the one we're going to be talking about, as Dave mentioned, the Monte Carlo branch, where allegedly the Bologna Railway Station bombing was planned. This, again, is also a Ted Rubenstein-supplied Jonathan Marshall translation, this one of the Italian magazine Panorama for 8th of August, 1982. The headline, Black at Monte Carlo, Gelli and the Bologna Massacre. November 1981, in a prison cell in Lausanne, that's Switzerland, of course, an Italian adventurer, Ilio Cellini, was serving time for a bankruptcy of 700 million lira. In Italy and in South America, where he had long worked, he left a long trail of bad checks in the hundreds of millions. 8 months before, he asked for a meeting with the Swiss Secret Service. He had important revelations. His testimony eventually was passed on to the Bologna magistrates investigating the train bombing. His revelations were horrifying. Fascists, P2 Masons, members of a new lodge in Monte Carlo, famous financiers, politicians, all together in a plot to undermine institutions and conquer power in Italy. The magistrates went to Switzerland to interview him. They discovered that he had dealt in South America with Stefano Della Chiai, sought in vain since the time of the Piazza Fontana massacre. He was let out of prison and in return, this is Cellini they're talking about, was let out of prison and in return produced documents that filled out that disquieting dossier. These revelations moved forward an inquiry that has been largely secret until now, with the arrest of Ezio Gianciglio, a Tuscan leader of P2 and organizer of the Masonic Executive Committee of Monte Carlo. The magistrates believed enough in Cellini's tale that on 15th of April, they issued an arrest warrant against Della Chiai and a group of fascists tied to the Avanguardia Nazionale. Later, they also implicated the Florentine lawyer Federico Federici, another member of the Monte Carlo Lodge. Finally, they arrested Gianciglio. All were people who played a role in a story that had its birth in 1979 in Monte Carlo. That year, P2 was in difficulty. Judicial investigations in Florence and Bologna on the Italicus case, that it was an earlier railway station bombing, in Bologna on the Italicus case had begun to penetrate that financial political plot. Gelli decided to create a new lodge in Monte Carlo, a state not covered by Masonry, and where he could set up a new Grand Orient recognized by the International Grand Lodge. He called it Comité. In it, he enrolled some people already belonging to P2 and some who haven't appeared yet on any lists.
So the P2 octopus, I guess you could say, has tentacles in many, many places, including Monte Carlo. And it was at the Monte Carlo Lodge, according to a dissident P2 member named Ilio Cellini, that the aforementioned Bologna massacre was planned, involving Licio Gelli and Stefano Della Chiai. One of the areas, too, where the P2 tangle began to reach out to with a vengeance was Greece, where the Italian fascists were actively involved in channeling money to the 1967 coup which brought the Greek colonels to power. And it's worth remembering here in this context that that coup was actively aided by the Central Intelligence Agency. About the P2 and specifically Michele Sindona's active assistance for the 1967 Greek coup, information about that appears in St. Peter's Banker by Luigi D'Afonso. He writes as follows. In April of 1967, Propaganda Due directed its attention to the upcoming elections in Greece. The Greek left was headed by 47-year-old Andreas Papandreou, a political foe of King Constantine II, who was the ruling monarch of Greece and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. The leftists were gaining ground and were expected to win the election. The army feared that the leftists would push Greece, the cradle of democracy, toward communist rule. Colonel Papadopoulos, dedicated to the service of the young King Constantine, predicted civil war if the left succeeded in assuming the leadership. Sometime around April of the same year, Continental Bank of Illinois, according to Sindona, now recall that interrupting here, that the chairman of that is David Kennedy, who's a co-investor with Sindona in a lot of Sindona's enterprises. Beginning again, sometime around April of the same year, Continental Bank of Illinois, according to Sindona, transferred $4 million to Sindona's Banca Privata Finanziaria. Upon receipt, Sindona immediately wired $4 million to Colonel Papadopoulos through the bank account of Helleniki Tekniki, a construction company controlled by the Greek army. The loan was guaranteed by the Central Bank of Greece. In the early morning hours of April 21st, Michele Sindona was sitting at home in his study, chewing on cubes of sugar as he waited for an important phone call. His eyes darted back and forth from the telephone to the portrait of Nunziata. He was nervous and the pain above his eye was throbbing. At 2 o'clock a.m. in Athens, the last light at Tetoi Palace went out. A few minutes later, soldiers slipped from the shadows, took command of every military station in Greece, and shut down all radio stations. Three soldiers and an officer appeared at the house of Premier Paniotis Kanellopoulos. The premier barricaded his door, but the officer, after explaining to the premier that he had come to protect him, ordered his men to break into the house. The soldiers grabbed the premier and dragged him into a waiting car. He screamed, "Why don't you kill me here?" unquote. Simultaneously, in the Athenian suburb of Kastri, former premier George Papandreou, father of Andreas Papandreou, was kidnapped from his house and locked up. At the same time, eight soldiers smashed the glass door to Andreas Papandreou's house. The soldiers overpowered Andreas and his bodyguard. They dragged Andreas, wearing only his underpants, across the broken glass and stuffed him into a car. The merchants of the right repeated scenes like these until 5,000 communists were in prison. At approximately 2:45 a.m., 15 minutes before the king would learn details of the coup, Michele Sindona's phone rang. The message was short and precise. "In the name of the king," the voice said, "we have succeeded," unquote. The pain above Michele's eye vanished. He was happy. He had assisted in what he considered to be a major defeat of the communists. At 3 o'clock a.m., in the same instant that three tanks positioned themselves in front of the palace gates, the Greek army ended the radio silence and announced to the rest of the world that it had, in the name of the king, taken control of the country. 2 years later, in December of 1969, a letter published in the London Times revealed a plot to overthrow the government of Italy and establish an Italian fascist state backed by sympathetic forces within Greece. The document was titled, quote, "Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Minister's Office, Reference Number 600A47, unquote, and was labeled strictly confidential, to be opened only by the ambassador, unquote. The document explained that a report from Greece's agents in Italy indicated that events are developing in a direction very favorable to the national revolution, unquote. It went on to say that Premier George Papadopoulos, the former colonel who had organized the 1967 coup in Greece, wanted to prevent any possibility of linking the activities of our Italian friends with the official Greek authorities, unquote. The report also quoted a mysterious man from Italy, identified only as Mr. P, unquote, believed to be Licio Gelli, appealing to Premier Papadopoulos, quote, to continue the supply of both moral and material help from Greece, as well as advice on the development of action groups. Mr. P is reported to have concluded, quote, conditions are much more favorable than in the past. Many people in Italy want to see the establishment of order and peace in their own country. So basically, not only does P2, and particularly Licio Gelli and Michele Sindona, aid the 1967 CIA-backed coup in Greece, but then the Greek colonels who so came to power attempted to perform a similar service for their Italian cohorts and allies, Messieurs Gelli and Sindona, and in all probability were lending material assistance to the 1970 Borghese coup about which we spoke earlier.
Now, as we continue to detail this spread of P2 terrorism, and we're going to detail next the spread of it into Spain and South America, bear in mind that what we are talking about here, when we're talking about the kind of people that we have been showing you illustrations of, people like Licio Gelli, Michele Sindona, and Stefano Della Chiai, people who obviously have no scruples whatsoever, and in fact are in most cases favor violent, murderous action over any other sort of action. Later on in the broadcast, when we're going to begin to be talking about things like the shooting of a pope, or as we talked about last week, we talked about the probable poisoning of a pope, namely John Paul I, it becomes obvious that we are not talking about people who are going to balk at such procedures. Just to remind you that there is a larger picture here, and not merely the succession of small events. Well, small except to the people they happen to.
What we're basically laying now is the groundwork and the context in which the shooting of the Pope happened, and we're also introducing many of these same elements that we're dealing with in the very show this evening are going to come right back in our next two shows in connection specifically with the shooting of the Pope.
Okay, now remember also the alleged letter from Licio Gelli talking about the formation of action groups. Now we're going to talk about Stefano Della Chiaia, the man who is the master of the action group.
Also, now recall the earlier killing of Judge Vittorio Accorsio by Pierluigi Concutelli. Now Accorsio was looking into a nomine sequestri in P2, and we're going to take a look at not only Della Chiaia's connections to the Accorsio killing, but also the international connections to that killing as well.
And I'm sorry, I just lost the name of this here.
The book is The Nazi Legacy by Linklater and Hirsch and Asherson.
Absolutely, okay. All right, again, talking about Stefano Della Chiaia, again, one of the if not the foremost black terrorist in the world, and by black, for those of you who just tuned in, it has nothing to do with African heritage, it means fascist.
Yeah, but again, Italian political shorthand, red is communist, black is fascist.
All right. His career, from now on, would concentrate less on the affairs of his homeland, namely Italy, where he could only return clandestinely, and more on Spain and South America, where right-wing governments were open to his ideas and interested in his unusual skills. Over the next 3 years, Della Chiaia kept a diary which was later discovered by Italian investigators, and it records the astonishing ease with which he was able to travel freely from country to country, although he was an internationally wanted man. In Spain, a country which was effectively still run as a police state, he never once had to apply for a residence permit. His name did not appear on the list of foreigners held by the Spanish police, and when he opened an office in a restaurant in Madrid, neither was entered on the commercial registers required under Spanish law. The police and the intelligence agencies, who were perfectly well aware of his identity, simply turned a blind eye. Yet the company he set up dealt in arms, and the restaurant, El Apuntamiento, was a regular thieves' kitchen patronized by right-wing terrorists. Scarcely any of those who ate or worked at the restaurant had residence papers, nor were the cooks and waiters regularly employed. Many of them were on police records as Italian right-wing extremists on the run. On most nights, unless he was on missions abroad, Della Chiaia, dressed in a khaki shirt or a light safari suit, would preside over the establishment with his wife Leda, an Italian ex-school teacher. Fights were common as the evenings wore on, and Della Chiaia would have to step in and break them up. Sometimes he himself was the focus of resentment, particularly from those of his colleagues who nursed grave suspicions about his contacts with the Italian authorities. Della Chiaia's diary says nothing about what he was really up to in Spain beyond speaking vaguely about meetings, operations, and missions. But evidence which emerged later, after the death of Franco, shows that not only did Della Chiaia import his strategy of tension into Spain in an attempt to shore up support for the right wing, he also waged a remarkable clandestine war against the Basque separatist movement ETA, an organization which posed a running threat to the Franco regime. From 1973 to 1976, operating permanently outside the law, yet on behalf of the Spanish authorities, Della Chiaia helped organize a series of raids against ETA, both in Spain and across the border in southwest France. On one occasion, two ETA terrorists hiding in France were found dead in mysterious circumstances. Later it emerged that their murderer, a 28-year-old Sicilian Luigi Concutelli, Pierre Luigi Concutelli, of course, had been brought to Spain by Della Chiaia, provided with papers and commissioned by him to carry out the killings. You may remember, if this is in fact the same Pierre Luigi Concutelli, this is the man who killed Judge Vito Accorsio, who was investigating the connections between the right wing and organized crime.